question on jinxes was not at all scientific. It was superstitious. Well, so be it. Life wasn't a hypothesis one could test and retest without consequence. Something always crashed eventually. Thus, he was constantly on the lookout for things that posed a threat to her. And, as of this morning, that thing was rowing. They'd flipped the pair yet again, his fault, and for the very first time, they'd ended up in the water on the same side of the boat, and he'd made a terrifying discovery. She couldn't swim. By the looks of her panicked dog paddle, she'd never had a swimming lesson in her life. That's why, while Elizabeth was off in the bathroom at the boathouse, he and 6:30 had approached the men's team captain, Dr. Mason. It was bad weather season. If he and Elizabeth were going to continue to row, she actually wanted to, it was best to be in an 8. Safer. Plus, if the 8 did flip, unlikely, there'd be that many more people to save her. Anyway, Mason had been trying to recruit him for more than 3 years. It was worth a shot. "What do you think?" he'd asked Mason. "You'd have to take both of us, though." "A woman? In a men's 8?" Dr. Mason had said, readjusting his cap over his crew cut. He'd been a Marine and hated it, but he'd kept the hairstyle. "She's good," Calvin said. "Very tough." Mason nodded. These days, he was an obstetrician. He already knew how tough women could be. Still, a woman? How could that possibly work? "Hey, guess what?" Calvin told Elizabeth a minute later. "The men's team really wants both of us to row in their 8 today." "Really?" Her goal had always been to join an 8. The 8s rarely seemed to flip. She never told Calvin she couldn't swim. Why worry him? "The team captain approached me just now. He's seen you row," he said. "He knows talent when he sees it." From below, 6:30 exhaled. "Lies, lies, and more lies." "When do we start?" "Now." "Now?" She felt a jolt of panic. While she'd wanted to row in an 8, she also knew the 8 required a level of synchronization she'd not yet mastered. When a boat succeeds, it's because the people in the boat have managed to set aside their petty differences and physical discrepancies and row as one. Perfect harmony. That was the goal. She'd once overheard Calvin telling someone at the boathouse that his Cambridge coach insisted that they even blink at the same time. To her surprise, the guy nodded. "We had to file our toenails to the same length. Made a huge difference." "You'll be rowing 2-seat," he said. "Great," she said, hoping he didn't notice the violent shake in her hands. "The coxswain will call out commands. You'll be fine. Just watch the blade in front of you, and whatever you do, don't look out of the boat." "Wait, how can I watch the blade in front of me if I don't look out of the boat?" "Just don't do it," he warned. "Throws off the set." "But..." "And relax."
"I..."
"Hands on," yelled the coxswain. "Don't worry," Calvin said. "You'll be fine." Elizabeth once read that 98% of the things people worry about never come true. But what, she wondered, about the 2% that do? And who came up with that figure? 2% seemed suspiciously low. She'd believed 10%, even 20. In her own life, it was probably closer to 50. She really didn't want to worry about this row, but she was. 50% chance she was going to blow it. As they carried the boat to the dock in the dark, the man in front of her glanced over his shoulder as if to try to understand why the guy who usually rowed 2 seats seemed smaller. "Elizabeth Zott," she said. "No talking," shouted the coxswain. "Who?" asked the man suspiciously. "I'm rowing 2-seat today." "Quiet back there," the coxswain yelled.
2-seat,
the man whispered incredulously. "You're rowing 2-seat?"
"Is there a problem?"
Elizabeth hissed back.
"You were great," Calvin shouted 2 hours later, pounding on the car's steering wheel with such excitement that 6:30 worried they might crash before they reached home. "Everyone thought so."
"Who's everyone?" Elizabeth said. "No one said a single word to me."
"Oh, well, you only hear from the other rowers when they're pissed. The point is, we're in the lineup for Wednesday."
He smiled, triumphant. Saved her again. First at work, and now this. Maybe this was the way one ended a jinx, by taking secret but sensible precautions. Elizabeth turned and looked out the window. Could the sport of rowing really be that egalitarian? Or was this just the usual fear from the usual suspects? Rowers, like scientists, were afraid of Calvin's legendary grudge-holding. As they drove along the coast toward home, the sunrise illuminating a dozen or so surfers, their longboards pointed at the shore, their heads turned, hoping to catch a few waves before work, it suddenly occurred to her that she'd never seen this supposed grudge-holding in action. "Calvin," she said, turning back toward him, "why does everyone say you hold a grudge?" "What's that?" he said, unable to stop smiling. "Secret, sensible precautions. The solution to life's problems." "You know what I mean," she said. "There's an undertone at work. People say if they disagree with you, you'll ruin them." "Oh, that," he said cheerfully. "Rumors, gossip, jealousy. There are people I don't like, certainly, but would I go out of my way to ruin them? Of course not." "Right," she said. "But I'm still curious, is there anyone in your life you'll never forgive?" "Well, no one comes to mind," he answered gaily. "You? Anyone you plan to hate the rest of your life?" He turned to look at her, her face still flushed from the row, her hair damp with ocean spray, her expression serious. She held out her fingers as if counting. Chapter 9. The Grudge. When Calvin claimed he held no grudges and hated no one, he only meant it in that way that some people say they forget to eat. Meaning he was lying. No matter how hard he tried to pretend he'd left the past behind, it was right there, gnawing at his heart. Plenty of people had wronged him, but there was only one man he could not forgive. Only one man he swore to hate until his dying day. He'd first glimpsed this man when he was 10. A long limo had pulled up to the gates of the boy's home, and the man had gotten out. He was tall, elegant, carefully dressed in a tailored suit and silver cufflinks, none of which fit with the Iowan landscape. With the other boys, Calvin crowded the fence. A movie star, they guessed, maybe a professional baseball player. They were used to this. About twice a year, famous people came to the home, reporters in tow, to get their pictures taken with a few of the boys. Occasionally, these visits resulted in a couple of baseball gloves or autographed headshots, but this man only had a briefcase. They all turned away. But about a month after the man's visit, all sorts of things started to arrive. Science textbooks, math games, chemistry sets, and unlike the headshots or baseball gloves, there was enough to go around. "The Lord doth provide," the priest said, handing out a stack of brand new biology books. "Which means you meek shall shut up and sit the hell still. You boys in the back, sit still, I mean it." He slammed a ruler on a nearby desk, causing everyone to jump. "Excuse me, Father," Calvin said, leafing through his copy, "but there's a problem with mine. Some of the pages are missing." "They're not missing, Calvin," the priest said. "They've been removed." "Why?" "Because they're wrong, that's why. Now open your books to page 119, boys. We'll start with..." "Evolution's missing," Calvin persisted, riffling through the pages. "That's enough, Calvin." "But..." The ruler cracked down hard against his knuckles. "Calvin," the bishop said wearily, "what's wrong with you? This is the fourth time you've been sent to me this week, and that doesn't count the complaints I've received from our librarian about your lies." "What librarian?" Calvin asked, surprised. Surely the bishop didn't mean the drunk priest who often holed up in the small closet that housed the home's pathetic book collection. "Father Amos says you claim to have read everything in our stacks. Lying is a sin, but brag lying, there's nothing worse." "But I have read—" "Silence!" he shouted, looming over the boy. "Some people are born bad apples," he continued, "the result of parents who were bad themselves. But in your case, I don't know where it comes from."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean," he said, leaning forward, "that I suspect you were born good but went bad, rotted," he said, "through a series of bad choices. Are you familiar with the idea that beauty comes from within?"
"Yes."
"Well, your insides match your outward ugliness." Calvin touched his swollen knuckles, trying not to cry. "Why can't you be grateful for what you've got?" the bishop said. "Half the pages in a biology book are better than none, aren't they? Lord, I knew this would be a problem." He pushed away from his desk and plodded about his office. "Science books, chemistry sets. What we have to accept just to get cash for the coffers." He turned to Calvin, angry. Even that's your fault, he said. We wouldn't be in this position if it weren't for your father.
Calvin jerked his head up. Never mind, the bishop retreated to his desk, picking up papers.
You can't talk about my father, Calvin said, heat rising to his face. You didn't even know him.
I get to talk about whomever I like, Evans, the bishop scowled. And anyway, I don't mean your father who died in the train wreck. I mean, he said, your actual father, the idiot who saddled us with all these damn science books. He came here about a month ago in a big limo searching for a 10-year-old whose adoptive parents got hit by a train, whose aunt wrapped her car around a tree, a young boy who might be, the man said, very tall. I went straight to the cabinet and pulled your file. Thought maybe he'd come to reclaim you like a misplaced suitcase. Happens all the time in adoptions. But when I showed him your photograph, he lost interest.
Calvin's eyes widened, taking in the news. He'd been adopted. That wasn't possible. His parents were still his parents, dead or not. He fought back tears, thinking of how happy he used to be, his hand tucked into the safety of his father's bigger one, his head resting against his mother's warm chest. The bishop was wrong. He was lying. The boys were always being told stories about how and why they ended up at All Saints. Their mothers died in childbirth, and their fathers couldn't cope. They were a problem to raise. There were already too many mouths to feed. This was just one more.
Just so you know, the bishop said as if selecting from a list, your real mother died in childbirth, and your real father couldn't cope.
I don't believe you.
I see, the bishop said dryly as he withdrew two pieces of paper from Calvin's file. An adoption certificate and a woman's death certificate. The budding scientist demands proof. Calvin stared down at the documents through a cloud of tears. He couldn't make out a single word.
All righty then, the bishop said, clapping his hands together. I'm sure this all comes as a shock, Calvin, but look on the bright side. You do have a father, and he is looking out for you, or for your education at least. That's far more than the other boys get. Try not to be selfish about this. You've been lucky. First you had nice adoptive parents, now you have a rich father. Think of his gift, he hesitated, as a remembrance, as a tribute to your mother, a memorial.
But if he's my real father, Calvin said, still not believing him, he would take me away from here. He would want me with him.
The bishop looked down at Calvin, his eyes open with surprise.
What? No, I told you. Your mother died in childbirth and your father couldn't cope.
No, we both agreed, especially after he'd read your file, that you're better off staying here. A boy like you needs a moral environment, lots of discipline. Plenty of rich people send their kids to boarding school. All Saints isn't that different.
He sniffed, taking in the sour smells from the kitchen.
Although he did insist that we swell our educational offerings, which I found presumptuous, he added, as he picked some cat hair off his sleeve. Telling us professional educators how to educate.
He rose, turning his back on Calvin, to look out the window at the roof that sagged on the west side of the building.
The good news is he did leave us a nice chunk of change, not just for you, but for the other boys too, very generous, or would have been if he hadn't earmarked all of it for science and sports.
God, rich people, they always think they know best.
He's a scientist?
Did I say he was a scientist? The bishop said. Look, he came, he made inquiries, he left. Left a check, too, far more than what most deadbeat fathers do.
But when's he coming back? Calvin begged, wanting more than anything to escape the home, even if it was with the man he didn't know.
We'll have to wait and see, the bishop said, turning away to look out the leaded window.
He didn't say.
Calvin trudged slowly back to his classroom, thinking about the man, thinking of ways to make him come back. He had to come back, but the only things that ever showed up were more science books. Still, he was a child, and as children do, he held on to his hope long after the hope should have expired. He read all the books his new-to-the-scene father had sent, devoured them as if they were love, stocking his broken heart with theories and algorithms, determined to uncover the chemistry he and his father shared, the unbreakable bond that linked them for life. But what he realized through his self-study was that the complexity of chemistry went well beyond birthright, that it twisted and turned in sometimes heartless ways. And thus, He had to live with the knowledge that not only had his other father discarded him without even meeting him, but that chemistry itself had spawned the grudge he could neither hide nor outgrow. Chapter 10. The Leash. Elizabeth hadn't had a pet before, and she wasn't sure she had one now. 630 wasn't human, but he seemed to possess a humanity that far surpassed what she'd found in most people. That's why she didn't buy him a leash. It seemed wrong, insulting even. He rarely strayed far from her side, never crossed the street without looking, didn't chase cats. In fact, the only time he'd ever bolted was on the 4th of July when a firecracker exploded right in front of him. After hours of worried searching, she and Calvin finally found him tucked behind some trash cans in an alleyway, shaking in shame. But when the city passed its very first leash law, she found herself reconsidering the idea, although for more complicated reasons. As her attachment to the dog grew, so too grew the idea of attaching the dog to her. So she bought a leash and hung it on the coat rack in their hallway and waited for Calvin to notice. But after a week, he still hadn't. "I got 630 a leash," she finally announced. "Why?" Calvin asked. "It's the law," she explained.
"What law?"
She described the new law and he laughed.
"Oh, that. Well, that doesn't apply to us. It's for people who don't have a dog like 630.
"No, it's for everyone. It's new. I'm pretty sure they mean business." He smiled.
"Don't worry. 630 and I pass the precinct almost every day. The police know us."
"But that's about to change," she insisted, "probably because there's been a surge in pet deaths. A lot more dogs and cats are getting hit by cars." She didn't know if this was factually true, but it seemed like it certainly could be. "Anyway, yesterday I took 630 out on a walk and used the leash. He liked it."
"I can't run with a leash," Calvin said, glancing up. "I hate feeling tethered. Besides, he always stays right with me."
"Something could happen."
"What could happen?"
"He could run out into the street. He could get hit. Remember the firecracker?"
"It's not you I'm worried about," she said. "It's him."
Calvin smiled to himself. It was a side of Elizabeth he'd never seen before, a mothering instinct.
"By the way," he said, "there's lightning in the forecast. Dr. Mason called. Rowing's been canceled the rest of the week."
"Oh, that's too bad," she said, trying not to sound relieved. She'd rowed in the men's 8 4 times now, and each time it had left her more exhausted than she cared to admit. Did he say anything else? She didn't want to sound like she was fishing for a compliment, but she was. Dr. Mason seemed like a decent man. He always spoke to her as an equal. Calvin had mentioned he was an obstetrician.
"He mentioned we're in the lineup for next week," Calvin said, "and that he'd like us to consider a regatta in the spring."
"You mean a race? You'll love it. It's fun."
Actually, Calvin was pretty sure she might not love it. Racing was stressful. The fear of losing was bad enough, but there was also that knowledge that the row itself was going to hurt, that once the word attention was called, the rower would risk heart attack, cracked ribs, lung donation, whatever it took, just to earn that dime store medal at the end. Coming in second? Please. It wasn't called first loser for nothing.
"Sounds interesting," she lied.
"It really is," he lied back.
"Rowing was canceled, remember?" Calvin said 2 days later, surprised to sense Elizabeth getting dressed in the dark. He reached for his alarm clock. "It's 4 a.m. Come back to bed." "I can't sleep," she said. "I think I'll go into work early."
"No," he begged. "Stay with me." He pulled at the covers and motioned her back in.
"I'll put that potato dish in the oven on low," she said, slipping on some shoes. "It'll make a good breakfast for you."
"Look, if you're going, I'm going," he said, yawning. "Just give me a few minutes."
"No, no," she said. "You sleep."
He woke an hour later to find himself alone. "Elizabeth," he called. He padded his way to the kitchen, where a pair of oven mitts sat on the counter. "Enjoy the potatoes," she'd written. "See you soon. XOXOXOE. "Let's run to work this morning," he called to 6:30. He didn't actually feel like going on a run, but that way they could all ride home together in one car. It wasn't because he cared about saving gas. It was because he couldn't stand the thought of Elizabeth driving home alone. There were trees out there, and trains. She'd hate it if she knew how much he worried and fussed, so he kept it to himself. But how could he not fuss over the person he loved more than anything, more than seemed even possible? Besides, she fussed over him too, making sure he ate, constantly suggesting he run indoors with Jack, buying a leash of all things. Out of the corner of his eye, he spied some bills and made a mental note to file the latest crop of flim-flam correspondence. He'd gotten yet another letter from the woman claiming to be his mother. "They told me you died," she always wrote. He'd also gotten one from an illiterate who claimed Calvin had stolen all his ideas, and another from a so-called long-lost brother who wanted money. Oddly, no one had ever written pretending to be his father. Maybe because his father was still out there, pretending he'd never had a son. Since he'd left the boys' home, the only other person besides the bishop to whom he ever admitted his father's grudge was, of all people, a pen pal. He'd never met the man, but they'd managed to establish a strong friendship. Maybe because, like confession, they both found it easier to talk to someone they couldn't see. But when the subject of fathers came up, this was after a year of steady, no-holds-barred correspondence, everything changed. Calvin had let it drop that he hoped his father was dead, and his pen pal, apparently shocked, reacted in a way Calvin hadn't expected. He stopped writing back. Calvin assumed he'd crossed a line. The man was religious and he was not. Maybe hoping your father was dead wasn't something one admitted in ecclesiastical circles, but whatever the reason, their tete-a-tete was over. He felt depressed for months. That's why he decided not to mention the fact of his undead father to Elizabeth. He deeply worried that she'd either react like his ex-friend had and drop him, or suddenly wake up to what the bishop had once described as his fatal flaw, an innate unlovability. Calvin Evans, ugly both inside and out. She had turned down his marriage proposal. Anyway, if he told her now, she might question why he hadn't told her before, and that was dangerous, because she might ask herself what else he had left out. No, some things were better left unsaid. Besides, she'd kept her work troubles to herself, hadn't she? Having a few secrets in a close relationship was normal. He pulled on his old track pants, then rummaged in their shared sock drawer, his mood lifting as he caught a whiff of her perfume. He'd never been one for self-improvement, never even gotten through Dale Carnegie's book about making friends and influencing people, because 10 pages in, he realized he didn't care what anyone else thought. But that was before Elizabeth, before he realized that making her happy made him happy, which he thought, as he grabbed his tennis shoes, had to be the very definition of love, to actually want to change for someone else. As he bent down to tie his laces, his chest filled with something new. Was it gratitude? He, the early orphaned, never before loved, unattractive Calvin Evans, had, by hook or by crook, found this woman, this dog, this research, this row, this run, Jack. It was all so much more than he'd ever expected, so much more than he ever deserved. He looked at his watch, 5:18 a.m. Elizabeth was sitting on a stool, her centrifuges on full spin. He whistled for 6:30 to come meet him at the front door. It was a little over 5 miles to work, and running together, they could be there in 42 minutes. But as he opened the door, 6:30 hesitated. It was dark and drizzly. "Come on, boy," Calvin said. "What's wrong?" Then he remembered. He turned back, grabbed the leash, bent down, and clipped it to 6:30's collar. Securely connected to the dog for the very first time, Calvin turned and locked the door behind him. He was dead 37 minutes later. Chapter 11. Budget Cuts. "Come on, boy," Calvin said to 6:30. "Let's pick it up." 6:30 moved to his place 5 paces in front of Calvin, then glanced back every so often as if to make sure Calvin was still there. As they turned right, they passed a newsstand. "City budgets hit rock bottom," screamed a headline. "Police and fire services at risk." Calvin put pressure on the leash, directing 6:30 to turn left into an older neighborhood filled with big houses and oceanic lawns. "Someday we'll live here," Calvin assured him as they jogged along. "Maybe after I win the Nobel." Which 6:30 knew he would win because Elizabeth said he would. As they took another turn, Calvin almost slipped on moss before gaining his stride. "Close one," he huffed as they neared the police station. 6:30 looked ahead at the squad cars lined up like soldiers awaiting inspection. But the cars hadn't been inspected. This was because the police department had suffered yet another budget cut, their third in 4 years. All three cuts had fallen under the Do More With Less initiative, the slogan dreamed up by some middle manager in the city's PR department. What it actually meant this time was that their jobs were on the line. Salaries had already been docked, raises were extinct, layoffs were next. So the officers did whatever they could to keep the layoffs at bay. They took the latest Do More With Less initiative and stuck it where it belonged, out in the parking lot with the patrol cars. Let the black and whites bear the budget cut brunt this time. No more tune-ups, oil changes, brake relining, retreads, light bulb changes, nothing. 6:30 didn't like the police parking lot, especially the way the police backed out in such a sloppy hurry. He didn't even like the friendly policeman who sometimes waved to them as he and Calvin jogged by, their slow trudge in sharp contrast to Calvin's vigor. They seemed depressed in 6:30's opinion, shackled by low pay, bored by routine, unchallenged by the endless minor emergencies that never called upon the life-saving training they'd learned at the police academy. As he and Calvin approached, 6:30 sniffed the air. It was still dark. The sun would rise in about 10 more. Crack! From the darkness came a hideous popping sound. It was like a firecracker. Sharp, loud, mean. 6:30 bucked in fright. What was that? He bolted, or tried to, but he was yanked back by the leash that connected him to Calvin. Calvin, too, reacted. Were those gunshots? And bolted in exactly the opposite direction. Pow, pow, pow! The explosion stuttered like a machine gun. In response, Calvin lifted his foot and lurched forward, yanking 6:30 this way, while 6:30, wild-eyed, lifted his front paws and yanked back as if to say, no, this way. And the leash, taut like a tightrope, left no room for compromise. Calvin brought his foot down in a slick of motor oil, slipping forward like a clumsy ice skater, the pavement coming up fast like an old friend who couldn't wait to say hello. Bam! As a thin trail of red created a dark halo around Calvin's head, 6:30 turned to help. But something bore down upon them, a huge ship of a thing that moved with such force it snapped the leash in two, flinging him off to the side. He managed to lift his head just in time to see the wheels of a patrol car bump over Calvin's body. Jesus, what was that? The patrolman said to his partner. They were accustomed to their car's constant backfires, but this was something else. They jumped out, startled to see a tall man lying on the ground, his gray eyes wide open, his head wound quickly soaking the sidewalk. He blinked twice at the policeman standing over him. Oh my God, did we hit him? Oh my God, sir, can you hear me? Sir? Jimmy, call an ambulance. Calvin lay there, his skull fractured, his arm snapped in two by the force of the police car. Around his wrist dangled the remnant of the leash. 6:30, he whispered. What was that? What did he say, Jimmy? Oh my God. 6:30, Calvin whispered again. No, sir, the policeman said, bending down beside him. It's almost six, but not quite. Actually, it's about 5:50. That's 5:50. Now we're going to get you out of here. We're going to get you fixed up. Don't you worry, sir. There's nothing to worry about. Behind him, police poured out of the building. In the distance, an ambulance screamed its intent of getting there soon. Oh, that's a shame, one of them said as air pressed out of Calvin's lungs. Isn't that the guy everyone always calls about? The guy who runs? From 10 feet away, 6:30, his shoulder wrenched from its socket, the other half of the leash dangling from his whiplashed neck, watched. He wanted more than anything to go to Calvin's side, to dip his face close to his nostrils, to lick his wounds, to stop everything from going any further than it already had. But he knew, even from 10 feet, he knew. Calvin's eyes drifted shut. His chest stopped moving. He watched as they loaded Calvin in the ambulance, a sheet over his body, his right hand hanging off the side of the gurney.
the snapped leash still wrapped tight around his wrist. 6:30 turned away, sick with sorrow. With his head down, he turned and went to give Elizabeth the bad news. Chapter 12. Calvin's Parting Gift. When Elizabeth was 8, her brother John dared her to jump off a cliff, and she'd done it. There was an aquamarine, water-filled quarry below. She'd hit it like a missile. Her toes touched the bottom, and she pushed up, surprised when she broke through the surface that her brother was already there. He jumped in right after her. "What the hell were you thinking, Elizabeth?" he shouted, his voice full of anguish as he dragged her to the side. "I was only kidding. You could have been killed." Now, sitting rigidly on her stool in the lab, she could hear a policeman talking about someone who died and someone else insisting that she take his handkerchief, and still another saying something about a vet, but all she could think about was that moment long ago when her toes had touched the bottom, the soft, silky mud inviting her to stay. Knowing what she knew now, she could only think one thing. I should have. It was her fault. This was what she tried to explain to the policeman. The leash, she'd bought it. But no matter how often she said it, he didn't seem to understand. And because of it, she thought there was a chance she'd imagine the whole thing. Calvin wasn't dead. He was rowing. He was on a trip. He was 5 floors up, writing in his notebook. Someone said go home. For the next few days, she and 6:30 lay on her unmade bed, sleep impossible, food out of the question, the ceiling their only vista, waiting for him to walk back through the door. The only thing that disturbed them was a ringing phone. Every time it was the same whiny voice, a mortician of all people, demanding that decisions must be made. A suit was needed for someone's coffin. Whose coffin? She said. Who is this? After too many of these calls, 6:30, seemingly exhausted by her confusion, nudged her toward the closet and pawed open the door. And that's when she saw it, his shirt swaying like long dead corpses at a hanging. And that's when she knew. Calvin was gone. Just like after her brother's suicide and Meyer's attack, she could not cry. An army of tears lay just behind her eyes, but they refused to decamp. It was as if the wind had been knocked out of her. No matter how many deep breaths she took, her lungs refused to fill. When she was a kid, she'd remembered overhearing a one-legged man tell a librarian someone was boiling water somewhere in the stacks. It was dangerous, he explained. She should do something. The librarian tried to assure him no one was boiling any water. It was a one-room library. She could see everyone. But he was insistent and shouted at her. And because of it, 2 men had to remove him, one of them explaining that the poor guy was still suffering from shell shock. He'd probably never recover. The problem was, now she heard the boiling water too. To stop the ringing phone, she had to find a suit. Calvin didn't own one, so she gathered what she felt he would have wanted, his rowing clothes. Then she took the small bundle to the funeral home and handed it to the funeral director. Here, she said. Long practiced in the art of dealing with the bereaved, the solemn man accepted the assortment with a courteous nod. But right after she left, he handed it to his assistant and said, "The stiff in room 4 is about 46 extra long." The assistant took the bundle and threw it in an unmarked closet where it joined a small mountain of other inappropriate outfits family members in their grief-stricken state had brought over the years. The assistant proceeded to a large wardrobe, grabbed a 46 extra long, shook the pants, blew lightly at the dust that grayed the shoulders, and headed for room 4. Before Elizabeth was even 10 blocks away, he'd successfully stuffed Calvin's rigid body within the suit's confines, shoving the hands that had once held her down dark sleeves, cramming the legs that once wrapped around her through woolen cylinders. Then he buttoned the shirt, buckled the belt, adjusted the tie, and knotted the laces, all the while brushing the dust that was so much a part of death from one end of the suit to the other. He stepped back to admire his work, then adjusted a lapel. He reached for a comb, reconsidered. He closed the door and walked down the hall to retrieve his brown bag lunch, pausing only to give instructions to a woman who sat behind a large adding machine in a small office.
Before Elizabeth had made it 12 blocks, the dirty suit had been added to her bill. The funeral was packed. A few rowers, one reporter, maybe 50 Hastings employees, a handful of whom, despite their bowed heads and somber clothing, weren't at Calvin's funeral to grieve, but to gloat. "Ding dong," they cheered silently, "the king is dead." As the scientists milled about, several noticed Zot way off in the distance, the dog by her side. Once again, the damn dog wasn't on a lead. This, despite the city's new leash law, and notwithstanding the signs that encircled the entire cemetery prohibiting dogs from entering in the first place. Same old, same old. Even in death, Zot and Evans acted as if the rules didn't apply to them. From a distance, Elizabeth shielded her eyes to take in the crowd. A well-dressed, nosy couple stood apart at a separate gravesite, watching the proceedings as if it were a 50-car pileup. She rested one hand on 630's bandages and considered how to proceed. The truth was, she was afraid to get close to the coffin because she knew she would try to pry it open and climb in and bury herself with him, and that meant dealing with all the people who would try to stop her, and she did not want to be stopped. 630 sensed her death wish, and because of it, had been on suicide watch all week. The only problem was, he wanted to die himself. Worse, he suspected she was in the same position, that despite her own deathly desires, she felt beholden to keep him alive. What a mess devotion was. Just then, someone behind them said, "Well, at least Evans got a good day for it." As if bad weather would have put a dampener on an otherwise festive funeral. 630 looked up to see a strong-jawed, skinny man holding a small pad of paper. "Sorry to disturb you," the man said to Elizabeth, "but I saw you sitting all by yourself over here, and I thought you might be able to help. I'm writing a story about Evans. Was wondering if I could ask you a few questions, only if you don't mind. I mean, I know he was a famous scientist, but that's all I know. Could you tell me how you knew him? Maybe supply an anecdote? Did you know him long?" "No," she said, avoiding his stare. No, I didn't know him long. Definitely not long enough." "Oh, right," he said, nodding. "I understand. That's why you're over here. Not a close friend, but still wanted to pay your respects. Gotcha. Was he your neighbor? Maybe you could point out his parents, siblings, cousins. I'd love to get some background. I've heard a lot of things about him. Some say he was a real jerk. Can you comment on that? I know he wasn't married, but did he date?" And when she continued to stare off into the distance, he added, lowering his voice, "By the way, I'm not sure you saw the signs, but dogs aren't allowed in the cemetery. I mean, not at all. The groundskeeper is supposedly a stickler about this one. Unless, I don't know, you need a dog, a seeing eye dog, because you're, well, you know."
"I am."
The reporter took a step back. "Oh, gee, really?" he said apologetically. "Oh, I'm so sorry. It's just that you don't look..."
"I am," she repeated.
"And it's permanent?"
"Yes."
"That's a shame," he said, curious. "Disease?"
"Leash."
He took another step back. "Well, that's a shame," he repeated, slightly waving his hand in front of her face to see if she would react. And sure enough, nothing. Just off in the distance, a minister appeared. "Looks like the party's starting," he said, telling her what he could see. "People are taking seats, the minister is opening the Bible," and he leaned way back to see if more people were coming from the parking lot. "And yet no family. Where's the family? There's not a single soul in the front row, so maybe he really was a jerk." He glanced back to get a response, surprised to see Elizabeth standing. "Lady," he said, "you don't have to go all the way over there. People understand a situation like yours." She ignored him, feeling for her purse. "Well, if you're really going, you better let me help you." He reached for her elbow, but the second he touched her arm, 630 growled. "Geez," he said, "I was only trying to help."
"He wasn't a jerk," Elizabeth said through gritted teeth.
"Oh," he said, embarrassed. "No, of course not. I'm sorry. I was only repeating what I'd heard. You know, gossip. I apologize. Although I thought you said you didn't know him that well."
"That's not what I said.
I said I didn't know him long enough," she quavered. "That's what I said," he replied soothingly, reaching for her elbow again. "You didn't know him very long."
"Don't touch me."
She wrested her elbow from his grip
and with 6:30 at her side, made her way across the uneven lawn, expertly avoiding stone angels and exhausted flowers as only one with 20/20 vision can do, and, embracing the loneliness of the front row, selected a chair directly opposite his long black box. What followed was the usual refrain, the sad looks, the dirty shovel, the boring verse, the preposterous prayers. But when the first clods of dirt hit the coffin, Elizabeth interrupted the minister's final tribute by announcing, "I need to walk." And then she turned, and with 6:30 walked away. It was a long walk home, 6 miles, in heels, in black, just the two of them. And it was curious. Both the route, which took them through as many bad sections as good, and the contrast, a colorless woman and injured dog planted against the conflict of an early spring. Everywhere they walked, even in the drabbest of neighborhoods, blooms poked their way up between sidewalk cracks and flower beds, shouting and boasting and calling attention to themselves, mingling their scents in hopes of creating complex perfumes. And there they were, in the thick of it, the only living dead things. The funeral car followed her for the first mile or so, the driver pleading for her to get in, informing her she'd last no more than 15 minutes in those heels, reminding her that she'd already paid for the ride, and apologizing that while he wasn't able to take the dog, he was certain someone from another car would. But she was as deaf to his pleas as she had been blind to the reporter's nosiness. And eventually, he and everyone else gave up, and Elizabeth and 6:30 did the only thing that made sense. They just kept walking. The following day, not able to be in her home and with nowhere else to go, they went back to work. This was a problem for her co-workers. They had already exhausted their full complement of things to say. "I'm so sorry. If there's ever anything you need, what a tragedy. I'm sure he didn't suffer. I'm there for you. He's in God's hands now." So they avoided her. "Take all the time you need," Donati had said to her at the funeral, putting his hand on her shoulder, while at the same time noting with surprise that black really wasn't her color. "I'm there for you." But when he saw her sitting on a stool in the lab in a daze, he avoided her too. Later, after it was clear that everyone was only going to be there for her as long as she was not there, she took Donati's advice and went away. The only place left to go was Calvin's lab. "This might kill me," she whispered to 6:30 as they stood in front of Calvin's door. The dog pressed his head into her thigh, begging her to go no farther. But she opened the door anyway, and they both stepped through. The scent of cleaning fluid hit them like a locomotive. Humans were strange, 6:30 thought. The way they constantly battled dirt in their above-ground world, but after death willingly entombed themselves in it. At the funeral, he couldn't believe the amount of dirt needed to cover Calvin's coffin. And when he saw the size of the shovel, he'd wondered if he should offer the help of his back legs to fill the hole. And now, dirt was again the issue, but in the wrong direction. Every last trace of Calvin had been scrubbed away. He watched as he stood in the middle of the room, her face blank with shock. His notebooks were gone, boxed up and already stored, while Hastings' management waited nervously to see if a next of kin type might come forward and try to claim them. It went without saying that she, who knew and understood his research better than anyone, and whose kinship with him far surpassed the meaning of kin, would not qualify. There was only one thing left, a crate where they'd tossed his personal effects, a snapshot of her, some Frank Sinatra records, a few throat lozenges, a tennis ball, dog treats, and at the very bottom, his lunchbox, which she realized with a heavy heart, probably still contained the sandwich she'd made him 9 days before. But when she opened it, her heart nearly stopped. Inside was a small blue box, and inside that, the biggest small diamond she'd ever seen. Just then, Miss Frask poked her head in.
"There you are, Miss Sott,"
she said, her rhinestone cat-eye glasses dangling like a sloppy noose from a chain around her neck.
"I'm Miss Frask, from personnel." She paused. "I don't mean to disturb you," she said, pushing the door open a bit wider, "but..."
Then she noticed Elizabeth going through the box.
"Oh, Miss Sott, you can't do that. Those things were his personal belongings, and while I know and recognize the... well, unusual relationship you and Mr. Evans enjoyed, we have to, by law, just wait a teeny bit longer to see if someone else, a brother, a nephew, blood, might step forward to claim those things, you understand? It's nothing against you or your personal, well, proclivities. I'm not making a moral judgment. But without some sort of document that says he actually meant to leave you his things, I'm afraid we have to follow the letter of the law. We've taken steps to secure his actual work. It's already under lock and key.
She stopped short, giving Elizabeth the once over.
Are you okay, Miss Saad? You look like you might faint.
And when Elizabeth slumped forward slightly, Miss Frask pushed the door all the way open and came in. After that day in the cafeteria, when Eddie looked at Zot in a way he'd never once looked at her, Frask found Zot hateable. I was in the elevator today, Eddie had swooned, and Miss Zot got in. We rode four whole floors together.
Did you and she have a nice chat? Frask said, her molars clenched. Find out what her favorite color is?
No, he said, but I'll definitely ask next time. Gee, she's something else. Frask had gone on to hear about exactly how Zot was something else at least twice a week since then. With Eddie, it was always Zot this and Zot that. He talked about her nonstop, but then everyone did. Zot, Zot, Zot. She was so fucking sick of Zot.
I'm sure I don't have to tell you, Frask said, placing a dimpled hand on Zot's back, that it's too soon for you to be at work, especially here, she said, tipping her head at the room that had once held Calvin. It's not good for you. You're still in shock and you need your rest.
Her hand moved up and down in a clumsy pat.
Now, I know what people are saying, she said, implying her role as ground zero when it came to Hastings gossip. And I know you know what people are saying, she continued, fairly confident Elizabeth did not. But in my opinion, whether or not Mr. Evans was getting the milk for free doesn't mean his untimely death hurts you any less. In fact, in my opinion, it is your milk, and if you choose to spoil it, that is your right.
There, she thought, satisfied. Now Zot knew what people were saying. Elizabeth looked up at Frask, stunned. She supposed it took a certain type of skill to be able to say exactly the wrong thing at exactly the wrong time. Maybe that was a prerequisite for a position in personnel, a certain clunky, cheerful cluelessness that gave one the ability to insult the bereaved.
I've been trying to track you down for several reasons, Frask was saying. The first being the issue of Mr. Evans' dog, him, she said, pointing a finger at 630, who stared back grimly. Unfortunately, he can't be here any longer. You understand? Hastings Research Institute absolutely venerated Mr. Evans and, because of it, overindulged his quirky tendencies. But now that Mr. Evans has left us, I'm afraid the dog must leave as well. As I understand it, the dog was really his dog anyway.
She looked to Elizabeth for confirmation. No, he's our dog, she managed. My dog.
I see, she said, but from now on, he'll need to stay at home.
From the corner, 630 lifted his head. I can't be here without him, Elizabeth said. I just can't. Frask blinked as if the room was too bright, and then from out of nowhere produced a clipboard on which she made a few notes.
Of course, she said without looking up. I like dogs too,
although she didn't.
But as I said, we made allowances for Mr. Evans. He was quite important to us, but at some point, she said as she put one hand back on Elizabeth's shoulder and started patting again, you have to realize the coattails only go so far.
Elizabeth's expression changed.
Coattails?
Frask looked up from the clipboard, trying to seem professional.
I think we know.
I never rode his coattails.
I never said you did, Frask said with mock surprise.
Then she lowered her voice as if confiding a secret.
Can I just say something? She took a short breath in. There will be other men, Miss Zot. Maybe not as famous or as influential as Mr. Evans, but men all the same. I studied psychology. I know about these things. You chose Evans. He was famous. He was single. Maybe he could help your career. Who could blame you? But it didn't work. And now he's gone, and you're sad. Of course you're sad. But look on the bright side. You're free again. And there are lots of nice men, good-looking men. One of them is sure to put a ring on your finger.
She paused, remembering ugly Evans just before she pictured pretty Zot back in the dating pool, men teeming about her like frothy bubbles in a bathtub.
And once you find one, she said, maybe a lawyer, she specified, then you can stop all this science nonsense and go home and have lots of babies.
That's not what I want, Frask straightened up.
Well, aren't we the little renegade, she said.
She hated Zot, she really did.
There's just one more thing, she continued, tapping her pen against the board, and that is your bereavement leave. Hastings has awarded you 3 extra days. That's 5 days total. Unheard of for a non-family member. Very, very generous, Miss Zot. And again, an indication of how important Mr. Evans was to us. This is why I want to assure you that you can and should go home and stay there with the dog. You have my permission.
Elizabeth wasn't sure if it was the cruelty of Frask's words or the foreign feel of the small, cold ring she'd buried in her fist just before Frask walked in. But before she could stop herself, she turned a wretch into the sink.
Normal, Frask said as she darted across the room to collect a wad of paper towels. You're still in shock.
But as she placed a second towel on Elizabeth's forehead, she adjusted her cat-eye glasses and took a much closer look.
Oh, she sighed judgmentally, drawing her head back. Oh, I see.
What? Elizabeth murmured.
Come on now, Frask said disapprovingly. What did you expect?
And then she tusked just long enough to make Zot understand she knew. But when Zot didn't acknowledge that she knew, Frask wondered if there was an outside chance Zot actually didn't know. That's how it was with some scientists. They believe in science right up until it happens to them.
Oh, I almost forgot, Frask said, withdrawing a newspaper from under the crook of her arm. I wanted to make sure you'd seen this. It's a nice photo, don't you think?
And there it was, the article from the reporter who'd attended the funeral. The brilliance he buried, claimed the headline, followed by a story that implied that Evan's difficult personality may have kept him from reaching his full scientific potential. And to prove that point, just to the right, was a photo of Elizabeth in 6:30, standing in front of his coffin with the caption, "Actually, love isn't blind," accompanied by a short summary of how even his girlfriend said she barely knew him. What a horrible thing to write, Elizabeth whispered, clutching her stomach.
You're not going to be sick again, are you? Frask scolded as she held out more paper towels. I know you're a chemist, Miss Zot, but surely you expected this. Surely you've studied biology.
Elizabeth looked up, her face gray, her eyes empty, and for one tiny moment Frask found herself almost feeling sorry for this woman and her ugly dog and the vomit and all the problems that were to come. Despite her brains and beauty and her incredibly slutty approach to men, Zot wasn't any better off than the rest of them.
Expected what? Elizabeth said. What are you getting at?
Biology, Frask roared as she tapped her pen against Elizabeth's stomach. Zot, please, we're women. You know very well Evans left you something.
And Elizabeth, eyes suddenly wide with recognition, was sick all over again. Chapter 13. Idiots. Hastings Research Institute management had a big problem. With their star scientist dead and a newspaper article implying that his lousy personality had kept him from accomplishing anything worthwhile, Hastings' benefactors, the Army, the Navy, several pharmaceutical companies, a few private investors, and a handful of foundations were already making noises about re-examining Hastings' existing projects and rethinking future grants. That's how it is with research. It's at the mercy of those who pay for it. Which is why Hastings' management was determined to lay this ridiculous story to rest. Evans had been making good progress, hadn't he? His office was overflowing with notebooks and strange little equations written in an indecipherable script and punctuated by exclamation marks and thick underlines like the kind one makes when one is on the brink of something. In fact, he was scheduled to present a paper on his progress in Geneva in just another month. Or would have, if he hadn't been backed over by a police car because he insisted on running outdoors in the rain instead of indoors in ballet slippers like everybody else. Scientists, they just had to be different. That was also part of the problem. Most of the Hastings scientists weren't different, or at least not different enough. They were normal, average, at best slightly above average. Not stupid, but not genius either. They were the kind of people who make up the majority of every company.
normal people who do normal work and who occasionally get promoted into management with uninspiring results. People who weren't going to change the world, but neither were they accidentally going to blow it up. No, management had to rely on its innovators, and with Evans gone, that left a very small pool of true talent. Not all of them were in lofty positions like Calvin's. In fact, a few of them probably didn't realize they were regarded as true innovators. But Hastings management knew it was from them that nearly every big idea and breakthrough came. The only real issue with these people, besides the occasional hygiene challenge, was that they always seemed to embrace failure as a positive outcome. "I have not failed," they'd endlessly quote Edison. "I have just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Which may be an acceptable thing to say in science, but is absolutely the wrong thing to say to a roomful of investors looking for an immediate, high-ticket, chronic treatment for cancer. God save them from actual cures. Much harder to make money off someone who doesn't have a problem anymore. For that reason, Hastings did whatever it could to keep these people away from the press, unless it was the scientific press, which was fine because no one read that. But now, dead Evans was on page 11 of the LA Times, and there, next to his coffin, Zot and the damn dog. That was management's third problem, Zot. She was one of their innovators. Unrecognized, of course, but she acted as if she knew. Not a week went by when they didn't get some complaint about her, the way she voiced her opinion, insisted her name appear on her own papers, refused to make coffee, the list was endless, and yet her progress, or was it Calvin's, was undeniable. Her project, abiogenesis, had only been approved because a fat cat investor had dropped from the heavens and insisted on funding, of all things, abiogenesis. What were the odds? Although this was exactly the sort of weird thing multimillionaires did, fund useless pie-in-the-sky projects, the rich man had said he'd read a paper by an E. Zot, something old out of UCLA, and had been fascinated by its expansion possibilities. He'd been trying to track Zot down ever since. Zot? "But Mr. Zot works here," they'd told him before they could stop themselves. The rich man had seemed genuinely surprised. "I'm only in town for a day, but I'd very much like to meet with Mr. Zot," he said. And they hemmed and hawed. Meet with Zot, they thought, and find out he was a she? His check was as good as gone. "Unfortunately, that won't be possible," they'd said. "Mr. Zot is in Europe at a conference." "What a pity," the rich man said. "Perhaps next time." And then he went on to say he'd only be checking in on the project's progress about once every few years, because he understood science was slow, because he knew it required time and distance and patience. Time, distance, patience. Was this man for real? "Very wise," they'd told him as they fought the urge to do backflips across the office. "Thanks for your trust." And before he was settled into his limo, they'd already carved up the bulk of his largesse to fund more promising research areas. They'd even given a bit of it to Evans. But then Evans, after they'd so graciously reinvested in his no real idea what the guy was actually doing research, he'd stormed into their offices, saying if they didn't find a way to fund his pretty girlfriend, he'd leave and take all his toys and ideas and Nobel Prize nominations with him. They'd begged him to be reasonable, make them actually fund abiogenesis. Come on! But he refused to budge, went as far as to assert that her ideas might even be better than his own. At the time, they wrote it off to the ramblings of a man who'd hit the jackpot, sex-wise. But now? Her theories, unlike the theories of all the Edison, "I'm not really a failure" quoters, appeared, at least according to Evans, to be dead on. Darwin had long ago proposed that life sprang from a single-celled bacterium, which then went on to diversify into a complex planet of people, plants, and animals. Zot? She was like a bloodhound on the trail of where that first cell had come from. In other words, she was out to solve one of the greatest chemical mysteries of all time, and if her findings continued apace, there was no question that she would do just that. According to Evans, at least. The only issue was it would probably take 90 years, 90 completely unaffordable years. The fat cat investor would surely be dead and far less, more to the point, so would they. And there was one other minor detail. Management had just learned Zot was pregnant.
as in unwed and pregnant. Could their day get any worse? Obviously, she had to go. No question about it. Hastings Research Institute had standards. But if she were to go, where did that leave them on the innovation front? With a handful of people making pokey pony progress, that's where. And pokey ponies didn't inspire much in the way of big-ticket grants. Fortunately, Zott did work with three others. Hastings management had sent for them straight away. They needed assurance that Zott's so-called critical research could limp along without Zott. Whatever it would take to make it seem as if the money it never actually got was being put to good use. But as soon as the three PhDs were in the room, Hastings management knew they were in trouble. Two reluctantly conceded that Zott was the main driver, essential to any forward progress. The third, a man named Borowitz, went the other route, claimed he'd actually done it all. But when he couldn't back up any of his assertions with meaningful scientific explanation, they realized they were in the presence of a scientific idiot. Hastings was rife with them. No surprise. Idiots make it into every company. They tend to interview well. The chemist sitting in front of them now, he couldn't even spell abiogenesis. And then, Miss Frask from personnel, the one who'd first sounded the alarm regarding Zott's condition, she'd used her limited talents to spread the Zott's knocked-up rumor, ensuring that all of Hastings knew of Zott's plight by noon. Which scared the hell out of them. The rumor's wildfire effect meant it was only a matter of time before the Institute's big investors knew, and investors, as anyone knew, hated scandals. Plus, there was the problem of Zott's rich man fan. The multimillionaire who'd written them a virtual blank check on behalf of abiogenesis, who'd claimed to have read Mr. Zott's old paper. How would he feel when he learned that Zott was not only a woman, but a knocked-up, unwed woman at that? God, they could picture that big limo swinging back round the drive, the chauffeur keeping the motor running as the man strode in and demanded his check back. "I was funding a professional slut," he'd probably shout. Trouble. They had to do something about Zott immediately. "I'm afraid you've put us in a terrible, terrible position, Miss Zott," scolded Dr. Donati a week later as he pushed a termination notice across the table in her direction. "You're firing me?" Elizabeth said, confused. "I'd like to get through this as civilly as possible." "Why am I being fired? On what grounds? I think you know." "Enlighten me," she said, leaning forward, her hands clasped together in a tight mass, her number two pencil behind her left ear glinting in the light. She wasn't sure from where her composure came, but she knew she must keep it. He glanced at Miss Frask, who was busy taking notes. "You're with child," Donati said. "Don't try and deny it." "Yes, I'm pregnant, that is correct." "That is correct," he choked. "That is correct." "Again, correct, I'm pregnant. What does that have to do with my work?" "Please." "I'm not contagious," she said, unfolding her hands. "I do not have cholera. No one will catch having a baby from me." "You have a lot of nerve," Donati said. "You know very well women do not continue to work when pregnant. But you, you're not only with child, you're unwed. It's disgraceful." "Pregnancy is a normal condition. It is not disgraceful. It is how every human being starts." "How dare you," he said, his voice rising. "A woman telling me what pregnancy is? Who do you think you are?" She seemed surprised by the question. "A woman," she said. "Miss Zott," Miss Frask stated, "our code of conduct does not allow for this sort of thing, and you know it. You need to sign this paper, and then you need to clean out your desk. We have standards." But Elizabeth didn't flinch. "I'm confused," she said. "You're firing me on the basis of being pregnant and unwed? What about the man?" "What man? You mean Evans?" Donati asked. "Any man. When a woman gets pregnant outside of marriage, does the man who made her pregnant get fired too?" "What? What are you talking about?" "Would you have fired Calvin, for instance?" "Of course not." "If not, then technically you have no grounds to fire me." Donati looked confused. "What? Of course I do," he stumbled. "Of course I do. You're the woman. You're the one who got knocked up." "That's generally how it works, but do you realize that a pregnancy requires a man's sperm?" "Miss Zott, I am warning you. Watch your language."
"You're saying that if an unmarried man makes an unmarried woman pregnant,
There is no consequence for him. His life goes on, business as usual.
This is not our fault, Frask interrupted. You were trying to trap Evans into marriage, it's obvious.
What I know, she said, pushing a stray hair away from her forehead, is that Calvin and I did not want to have children. I also know that we took every precaution to ensure that outcome. This pregnancy is a failure of contraception, not morality. It's also none of your business.
You've made it our business, Donati suddenly shouted. And in case you weren't aware, there is a surefire way not to get pregnant, and it starts with an A. We have rules, Miss Sott, rules.
Not on this you don't, Elizabeth said calmly. I've read the employee manual front to back.
It's an unwritten rule,
and thus not legally binding. Donati glowered at her.
Evans would be very, very ashamed of you.
No, Elizabeth said simply, her voice empty but calm. He would not. The room fell silent. It was the way she kept disagreeing without embarrassment, without melodrama, as if she would have the last say, as if she knew she'd win in the end. This is exactly the kind of attitude her co-workers had complained of, and the way she implied that hers and Calvin's relationship was at some higher level, as if it had been crafted from non-dissolvable material that survived everything, even his death. Annoying. As Elizabeth waited for them to come to their senses, she laid her hands flat on the table. Losing a loved one has a way of revealing a too simple truth, that time, as people often claimed but never heeded, really was precious. She had work to do. It was all she had left. And yet here she sat with self-appointed guardians of moral conduct, smug judges who lacked judgment, one of whom seemed unclear on the process of conception, and one who went along because she, like so many other women, assumed that downgrading someone of her own sex would somehow lift her in the estimation of her male superiors. Worse, these illogical conversations were all taking place in a building devoted to science.
Are we done here? She said, rising.
Donati blanched. That was it. Zott needed to go right now and take her bastard baby, cutting-edge research, and death-defying romantic relationship with her. As for her rich investor, they would deal with him later.
Sign it, he demanded.
As Frask tossed Elizabeth a pen.
We want you out of the building no later than noon. Salary ends Friday. You are not allowed to speak to anyone regarding the reasons for your dismissal.
Health benefits also end Friday,
Frask chirped, tapping her nail against her ever-present clipboard.
Tick-tock.
I hope this might teach you to start being accountable for your outrageous behavior,
Donati added as he held out his hand for the signed termination notice.
And stop blaming others, like Evans, he continued, after he forced us to fund you, after he stood in front of Hastings management and threatened to leave if we didn't.
Elizabeth looked as if she'd been slapped.
Calvin did what?
You know very well, Donati said, opening the door.
Out by noon, Frask repeated as she tucked her clipboard under her arm.
References could be a problem, he added, stepping out into the hall.
Coattails, Frask whispered.
Chapter 14. Grief. The thing 6:30 hated most about going to the cemetery was the way it took him past the place where Calvin had died. He'd once heard someone say it was important to be reminded of one's failures, but he didn't know why. Failures, by their very nature, had a way of being unforgettable. As he neared the cemetery, he kept an eye out for the enemy groundskeeper. Seeing no one, he pressed himself under the back gate and scooted through the rows, nabbing a clutch of fresh daffodils from one tombstone before laying it here. Calvin Evans, 1927 to 1955. Brilliant chemist, rower, friend, lover. Your days are numbered. The tombstone was supposed to have read, "Your days are numbered. Use them to throw open the windows of your soul to the sun," a quote from Marcus Aurelius. But the tombstone was small, and the engraver had made the first part too big and had run out of room. 6:30 stared at the words. He knew they were words because Elizabeth was trying to teach him words, not commands, words. How many words does science tell us dogs can learn? She'd asked Calvin one evening.
About 50, Calvin said, not looking up from his book.
50, she'd said, scrunching her lips together. Well, that's wrong. Maybe 100, he said, still engrossed in his book.
100, she'd answered just as incredulously. How can that be? He already knows 100.
Calvin looked up. Excuse me?
I'm wondering, she said, is it possible to teach a dog a human language? I mean, the whole thing, English, for example.
No.
Why?
Well, Calvin said slowly, realizing that this might be one of those things she simply didn't accept. There were so many of those things.
Because intraspecies communication is limited by brain size. He closed his book. How do you know he knows 100 words?
He knows 103, she said, consulting her notebook. I'm keeping track.
And you've taught him these words?
I'm using the receptive learning technique, object identification. Like a child, he's automatically more receptive to memorizing objects he's interested in. And he's interested in food. She got up from the table and started gathering books. But I'm sure he has lots of other interests.
Calvin looked back at her in disbelief.
So that's how their word quest had started. He and Elizabeth on the floor, flipping through big children's books.
Son, she'd instructed, pointing at a picture.
Child, she'd read in turn, pointing at a little girl named Gretel eating a candied house shutter. That a child would eat a shutter did not surprise 6:30. In the park, children ate everything. This included whatever they could find up their nose. From off to the left, the groundskeeper shuffled into view, a rifle resting on his shoulder. A strange thing, in 6:30's opinion, to carry in a place of the already dead. Crouching, he waited for the man to leave, then relaxed his body down the length of the casket buried below. Hello, Calvin. This is how he communicated with humans on the other side. Maybe it worked.